Welcome back, everyone. Glad to be able to speak with you again. I'm Henrik Halmgren from Sweden, and I hope you're having a good day today. Manage to stay cool, focused, and remain interested in the topics that are important, as the absurdity of willful participants and the demise of our connection to everything that is rooted in nature increases. The march towards the edge of the cliff pushes forward. And to that extent, self-righteousness and delusion seems to be stronger than ever. But I urge you to hang on, stand your ground, and open your eyes, and learn, understand what really is going on in the world. And to that effect, this is what we hope that our program can bring to you as well, not only curiosity in the unknown, but also clarity and understanding. If you're catching us on redicecreations.com or redicemembers.com, either of our websites or any of the other channels that pick up our radio feed or videos, we say welcome to everybody, and we're glad that you're along. We have a great program lined up for you today. We are going to continue our theme on Norse myth, Asatru, and the Viking Age that we began a few weeks ago. This is, I would say, the balancer to all the negative analysis that we have done on Scandinavia and the Nordic model in the last few years. As we look back into history and the culture, we find a pure heart, and we're going to set the record straight on some historical misconceptions as well today. We have Maria Kvilhaug with us from Norway. She is a historian of religions. She graduated with a master's degree in Old Norse mythology and initiation rituals from the University of Oslo. Her master dissertation was the later published work The Maiden with the Mead, a goddess of initiation in Old Norse myths. She is also the author of The Seed of Yggdrasil. She runs the YouTube channel Earth Mythic Library under the username Lady of the Labyrinth, which is inspired by the Minoan term Labyrinthos Potnia, labyrinths and labyrinth games and legends with a lady or a maiden in the middle abound in Scandinavian prehistory. Maria takes a historical and spiritual approach to Old Norse myths and legends, and considers them on par with many other classical philosophical principles as part of a heritage. Cultural roots and ancestral roots, she says, matter to all people wherever they are from. We'll dive into history, the Norse sagas, Asatru, and of course, what spurred the Vikings to go on their raids. Hi, Maria. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Nice to have you with us today. Hope you're doing well and that the weather is starting to heat up a little bit over in Norway.
Thank you. Yes, the weather is very nice here now. It's hot, actually. Well, relatively.
Well, that's great. And early spring, yeah, that's never a bad idea when you've had a long, cold winter and dark one, of course. So before we get into all the interesting content that you've been immersed in, you can tell us how long, of course, but what drove you to Norse mythology, Asatru, and everything else that you've been studying in the beginning, since this is somewhat of a hidden chapter, unfortunately, in our Scandinavian heritage?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Well, I would say that I was probably not driven to Asatru. It's more like Asatru has been driven to me, which I found to be very rewarding, actually. Well, I grew up with Norse myths in many ways. I grew up in a family of readers and intellectuals, and you know what some people lately have called cultural Marxists. And <That's> where fun. I'm from in Norway, that is often exactly the sort of families that are most eager to convey cultural traditions to their children.
That's right.
My father is, he was the first person in his family to have a university education, and he became a philosopher, and he taught me a lot about Greek philosophy and mythology. And well, we went on holidays. We usually went to see a lot of ruins and museums in other countries. But we also regularly visited the Viking ship museum in order to look at the Oseberg ship, as well as we visited the archaeological museum. And I was given tons of books about mythology, both Norse mythology and other mythologies. But I think perhaps the most important early influence was my own grandfather, Einar Kvilhaug. He came from a long line of seamen, his father and his father and his father before him. They were all sailors, just as he was. And, well, he said it went all the way back to the Vikings, but yeah, he said many things. But he grew up in Vestfold, which is very close to the, well, it is Well, he grew up very close to where the Osebag ship was excavated, and there are also countless other ancient burial mounds there that are, you know, scattered all over that area in Norway.
Yeah.
And the Osebag ship, it was first excavated in 1918, and that was the year he was born. So he grew up with news and theories about that burial site. His family were very interested in local history as well, and they were very, very proud of being from Tønsberg, which they believed was the oldest town in Norway at the time. And so he told me a lot about how he and his friends had played around the burial mounds and pretended to be Vikings, and his interest in that ancient heritage was very, very strong, and he loved to tell stories, and I loved to listen to his stories. So he often took me, I think, for hikes in the forest. And when I spent time with my grandparents down at the summer cottage in Vestfold, he often took me to, well, he took me to this particular old burial mound where we sat. And he told me about many things about the past, and he told me that our ancestors often sat on burial mounds to connect with ancestors. And he let me think, I was a child, you know, so he let me think that the grave belonged to a Bronze Age queen who was probably my ancestor. And I used to think about that mound as the grave of my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. So, of course, people called him, well, in Norwegian, they called him a skrønmaker. That means someone who makes up stories. But you could say that he spurred my imagination that way a lot. And he could retell many stories from the sagas and recite Edda poetry to me.
Wow, I wish I had a grandfather like that. That would be amazing.
Yeah, very lucky.
You're lucky, but yeah, you are.
Great man. And I have also think I've seen later that his way of transmitting knowledge and his way of being in the world and his kind of dry, ironic humor about human folly, the way he was, he was like, he was like taken out of those sagas in many ways, and it was very impressive for me because he was very different from anyone else I knew.
So is it possible that he actually had some of the oral tradition that's been passed down, despite what other people said about his making this up?
He never, I mean, he, well, I believed him, and, you know, I believe him still, you know, it's, he told me great stories, but I don't know which, how much of it is actually true or not. There is no way for me to know that. I can't know that. But I know that he knew a lot about these things, and that if he told me these stories, he was making me interested by using ways of telling, you know, like making it relevant for me, you know. Like, this is your ancestor. Wow, this is my great-great-great-great-grandmother. That was amazing for a child to think like that. And
sure.
It spurred my interest a lot. So even if it wasn't true, I think that, it was very useful for me to believe that. And, And he also, when he died, the day he died, I was actually the last person to see him. And he told me then on his deathbed that Maria, I have never been much of a Christian. I hope there will not be too much preaching in my funeral because I have that in my life.
That's funny.
And he said he didn't know exactly what he believed about the afterlife, but he thought that he said that, I think perhaps I'm more of a heathen at heart, he said. And he told me this because he also told me that he had dreamt of a shining bright tree where all his family and friends and, you know, his ancestors were waiting for him. And he thought perhaps that that was where he was going. And, yeah, I suppose he represented to me a link to the past.
Wow.
So that was the first thing. But at the time he died, I had already begun studying Norse mythology, and he was very proud of that, very happy to see what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad.
Because you're rare in that department, right? I mean, obviously there are very academic and scholarly approaches within the Scandinavian countries of this particular, you know, period in history, obviously. But nonetheless, on a more kind of just on an interest level of just being something that you adopt into your life, that's fairly rare, I would say, at least in Sweden. I don't know about Norway, but would you say that's true?
Yes, I think I've been very, very lucky. Because people thought he was making up stories, lots of people didn't take him seriously, but I did all my life, from when I was very, very small, and that's why he sort of, I think he just thought that he could teach me a lot, and I think that's very unique. I think very, very few people have grandparents like that anymore, but I shouldn't speak about him because I get a little sad.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I didn't mean to bring that up.
I brought it up.
Yeah, you should. Well, no.
I have to stop talking about him now. But I had a sort of rediscovery, because his way of teaching me was just an integral part of my life, and I didn't really think that consciously about it, and I sort of had a lot more international approach to these myths, not the Norse myths, but there was a long time when I studied World Heritage, and I sort of left. I'm a woman, and I was very interested in goddess lore and women's history, and that was sort of what spurred me. And I had this impression that Norse myths were a lot more masculine, and so I didn't look at them for a long time, and then I rediscovered them, which was quite interesting. It's an interesting story, too, because I had actually moved out of Norway and moved to England at the time.
Sometimes you have to leave to realize what you have back home, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was probably that. I had left Norway and moved to England to study art, and I somehow not really studied my own mythical heritage for a while, but I lived in this collective with lots of students from all over the world, and exactly because we were all exiles and all from different places, we started to talk a lot about our home traditions. And I realized that I didn't really know that much about my own traditions at the time, and they were sitting there. There was this Japanese girl. She made this gorgeous Japanese dinner and showed us, we started to have these evenings where someone would make food from their own country and talk about it. And I felt a bit, why do I not have this?
Isn't that interesting? Very indicative of what has happened, I believe, in Scandinavia. I don't want to get too political here, but I think that there's a lot of things involved in the fact that we've kind of turned on our heritage. So that's very indicative and interesting. But please carry on the story.
I knew I had to sort of start to think, dig very deep to remember. And then I started to remember that my grandmother taught me lots and lots of songs, and that my grandfather, he taught me all these things. I started to remember these things at least. And one day, actually, I walked into a bookstore, and suddenly that was a very fateful day, because someone had in the bookstore had put out the Poetic Edda in English translation. The Caroline Larrington translation, and it was staring me right in the face when I came into the bookstore, and I was like, wow, they have this here, because I didn't think that the Edda poetry would be known, in country, and I was like, wow, it's translated into English. So I bought it and took it home and started to read it, and it was so different from what I sort of remembered. Was so much more to it, and I had a bit of a mystical experience with that book, because I started to read it, and I had began having dreams, and and I had this, it was like being called in a way. I had a drive, there was this extreme interest in, I really, really, really wanted to understand what they were doing.
I definitely understand that. So it's a drive there, and something kind of pulled you into it, and you that kind of awoken something in you, I guess, right?
Yes, definitely. And in the beginning, because I was into this goddess lore, I was looking very much out for that. That was something that drove me on a while. Because that was also a personal thing, actually, because I I felt a bit left out in this world, that I didn't feel like I fit in with you know, what women were supposed to be in our time. It's like, I don't know what I can say about that, but I think that many women who are into spiritual legacies, they might find themselves quite underrepresented, that is, something was lost, and I felt as if I had been left out because I was a woman, and I reacted very strongly to that, and I didn't fit into the modern ideas about being a woman, where, you know, on the one side, we were supposed to be exactly equal and the same as men in every way, and on the other side, we were supposed to be, look like sort of Barbie dolls and be sort of super women, and, you know, most other women my age, or girls at the time, were extremely concerned with their appearance and criticizing themselves for being too fat or something. And for me, when I went into Goddess Lore, it was not so much about politics or feminism, but about spirituality and being a woman, perhaps. And I realized when I looked at the other girls that they were not that, you know, they were not so much suppressed by men as such. They were more harassing themselves all the time, and they were ganging up together to agree about their own self-harassment. And I heard all of them, look at me, I'm so fat. Oh no, look, I look so fat in this outfit. Oh no, you are not fat, I'm the fat one. And almost arguing about who was the fat one. And, you know, I feel so bad about eating that chocolate. And it was quite horrible. For me, it was very, very bad. I took it very seriously, and I thought it was very, very sad to watch. And
I bet. Wow.
I even tested out how they would react if I gorged down a Snickers king size in their presence.
That's funny.
About it, and, you know, not even saying once how I should not have eaten that chocolate. But,
right.
You know, and they were shocked. And then you live in a world where people are shocked if people say that they like to eat the chocolate.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't know that many people like that anymore, but this was, you know, what I saw in when I went to school and things, and reading all these glossy magazines crammed with diet tips and images of how you were supposed to look, and I'm just sort of glad I had the self-esteem I had, because any other girl would probably have succumbed to that sort of oppressive prison thought and started whining about their calories and all that just to fit in.
Right.
And obviously to me, these modern girls have been told all their lives that they were equal to men, but they had not been taught to cultivate actual self-respect. And it is very hard for people to respect those who do not respect themselves. And so that was why this was important to me, because when I was then that age, when I discovered those old goddess traditions and the existence of ancient cultures where women had a different standing, I would just say that I really do recommend giving a lot of books and stuff about goddesses and you know, resourceful women in history to your daughters if you want them to grow up feeling good about being women, because I was very happy about it, so I just felt a bit alone. And then Norsemith came, and I had this focus, and that helped me a lot to see exactly how much female characters actually mean in those stories.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I had to sort of try to understand how that fit in with the fact that this was a very, very warlike and patriarchal society. So that in itself spurred me onto more research, and I think I sort of found more, I found the balance that I had been missing, because I found that it was not so much about one gender being more in power than the other, but about both genders representing different and complementary powers that, you know, that reside within us, whether we are men or women, and in the world at large. So little by little, I think the issue of gender became less important to me than the issue of understanding these myths on their own terms and trying to understand the culture that created them. Because what I was discovering was that we have here deeply philosophical and spiritual messages that in these myths, but they seem to be at odds with the general image of Vikings and their culture.
Right, exactly.
This is usually presented as very primitive and brutal.
So how did you go about kind of sorting that out, and what did you find out? Because just as you say, you hear very much about a contradiction in terms of, as soon as you begin studying it a little bit, you realize that, wait a minute, there seems to have been an equality there in place, a kind of a natural equality where the roles aren't necessarily kind of skewed or politicized in the sense that they are today, of course, for purposes of ultimately control, as you described with the how we see women grow up today with the self-esteem issues and everything else. But, you know, we hear traditions also on the top of that, then that we have a tradition of both free men and women within Scandinavian culture. We have stories of the shield maidens, the Volva, the kind of the seeresses and everything else that seems to have been tremendously influential, that actually guided a lot of the decisions that the male patriarchal society that you talked about very much kind of took into account as well, right? So what did you find out?
Yeah, I found this, okay, so we can't speak of equality, I think. It was very hierarchical society, and I think that women generally ranked a little lower than men, although there were, of course, exceptions. But what I see in these stories, in everything, is that these women had a lot of self-respect and self-esteem, and that they were taken seriously. They could, you know, what is the tragedy with the later development with Christianity and things, I think is, well, not only did women have less rights with when Christianity came, because women had a lot of rights protecting them, even if they were not equal. But the Christian religion introduced a view on women and on the body and sex that was very, very negative.
Yes.
And the difference, I think, is that they didn't have that. They didn't have this negative view on women. They thought that women were, you know, well, obviously not all women are wise, but they thought that women could be, women's intelligence was not underestimated.
Exactly.
They were heard. And I don't think people would have noticed because everybody, both men and women, had to do a lot of things out of duty in those days. There was a lot of duty calls. So I don't think women felt that they were being, you know, oppressed or that they were being lesser because they had to do their duty just like everybody else did. But instead they cultivated this strength within, that they were strong. They didn't take any shit. They were, you know, and they were taken seriously too. You know, the men respected the Norsemen, they respected their women. So it's a very, very crucial difference, because we live in a time where people are more equal and where there is less rank, but also we see a lot of people, both men and women, with very low self-esteem in our days. And I think that's a very big difference from our time and theirs.
Well, definitely. I would even say that the equality that we hear about is all theatrics, is all very peripheral. It's all about very rudimentary or very kind of peripheral, very basic stuff, basically, that doesn't have, a kind of a deep, profound impact on the people who are living in these times. Because I think the cultural tradition at the time, we have to keep in mind as well, is based on survival. I mean, a method was built up where you had to have a structure within society where things actually were in its place, because if things fell out of line, you could literally, you're gambling with the entire lives of the tribe, right? There's a reason for why this happened. It's just not, isn't that someone who sat around the table one day and said, I'm going to find out a way to control everybody and create a hierarchical society because I just like it. You see what I'm saying? It's like it was based very much on a survival mechanism that comes out of an early period where mankind was living at the brink of extinction, you know?
Exactly. That's it. They had to have this sort of organization, I think. I think we won't understand them properly if you don't understand that they had the warrior culture, and because they were always under threat of violence and war and invasion and slavery, so they had to be strong and they had to build up a society where everybody cooperated to keep safe and have a good life. They were very fond of peace, actually. They always prayed for peace. That's a very, very important prayer, to pray for peace. But so it's not like they wanted to have war all the time, but they knew that that was just a fact of life, and they had to be organized that way. And I think we might understand them better if you think that they're a tribe in those times. It was not just a tribe, it was almost like an army.
Yes.
Everybody had to play their parts, and everybody had to sort of be,
fulfill their roles, basically, the tasks that they were given within that society.
Follow duties, and they had to follow a certain ranking system. But they had a lot of, we think that the ranking system was so strict, but they had a lot of contrary rules in a way.
Yes.
There were lots of outlets. So I think they built their society very wisely in many ways. That there was a original, I mean, obviously things changed during the Viking Age, but they came from a place where people have obviously thought that, okay, we need to have this sort of strict rules, ranks, they had an organized society. But with wisdom, there was a lot of wisdom in the way they originally organized the society, a way of letting people be free and be able to speak out, and at the same time be, while they had to still, you know, sort of think as if they were in an army, where people have to do what the general says sometimes, you know,
that's just
how it was. And I don't, as I often say, I don't glorify this age. I don't think, I mean, it's quite harsh, but I think what we feel is attractive about this, that sense we get when we hear their words and we read their stories, and you get this feeling that these people had this, wow, they respected themselves and they accepted the totality of being human in a way.
Yes.
We don't do today, and I think we miss that a bit. So I'm all for equality. I didn't mean that by saying, I don't mean that it's better to have that, this or that. It's just that I'm saying that we may, like I was in the beginning, I was a bit blinded by the fact that, oh shit, these people were very patriarchal and very warlike and all. I can't really stand for this, but then right. I tried to understand, and then I started to understand the logic that's in it, and I started to realize that in many ways they were more free than we are today, even though they were also more duty-bound than we are.
Very good point. I mean, in contrast, by today as well, we have kind of demolished the majority of these rules, the parameters that was based upon the idea of survival. It's a perception, of course, that today we have a newfound wisdom that it's better, and this is kind of at the root of what you mentioned before, a little bit of the ideas of cultural Marxism, that the family core, for example, that the tribe is kind of tyrannical by default, therefore, it needs to be broken down. But the issues that arise when you take this away is one where we do not understand the roles, and therefore the ideas of equality that you mentioned before is kind of very much peripheral. It's very much about fighting them on a level which is all about the almost on a material level completely, but you forget there's no spiritual component there. There's nothing that takes into account the deeper factors that have been involved in creating a human society for thousands of years. And for us to just to think that we can start from scratch on a unstable, base plate, I don't think that's going to work in the long run. So that's a very good point. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I think we need to sort of, we could learn, we don't have to, copy them, but we could perhaps learn a little bit from them. And realize that, ranking was not always about worth. You could rank lower than someone, but that still be equally worth, or just still feel like you're a fully, complete human being.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think people suffer that much from depressions in those days.
No, I don't think so.
or society issues or anything like that.
No luxury problems of which candy bar you're going to pick,
No, that's not. they have to make everything from scratch. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a gratifying lifestyle in that regard, right? Just a connectivity with everything that it seems like we've lost today. That's why I'm so amazed by it and drawn to it as well, because it has a rawness there, but there is a such truth in it. It's rooted in the natural order of things, And I'm drawn to it,
Yes, that's what also started to draw me to it. So this total acceptance of nature, of human nature and of nature, that they had this, it was all sacred to them.
Yeah.
All of it. So it's, they have the honor codes. They're very, very important. I mean, honor was very important to them. So that probably helped them a lot in, you know, dealing with each other in a nice way as much as possible, but still, you know, they didn't feel sinful, and I think they were very just that, not feeling guilty or sinful or worthless. That's something they have to teach us, I think.
Absolutely. Well, it's a very good point. So there is we can go 100 of different ways here. Obviously, I wanted to just ask you a little bit more about your books, though, before we kind of carry on and continue our conversation here. And just so you started writing a couple of books on the subject, and tell us just briefly about that. What kind of inspired you to do that, and what are some of the areas that you mainly are focusing on in your work?
Okay, I always wanted to be a writer. That I knew that when I was a child, but I didn't actually write anything like big before I wrote my master dissertation, and that was a thesis for my master graduation at the University of Oslo, where I had studied cultural history, religions, and Norse philology, Old Norse philology. And my thesis was called The Maiden with a Mead, a goddess of initiation rituals in Old Norse myths. So in this work, I wrote about how it is possible to detect a structure of initiation rituals in almost all the Edda poems, and that most of these rituals follow, this structure follows a particular pattern of seeking visions, having visions, going into the underworld, facing trials down there, and then finding the abode of a golden woman who serves a very precious kind of mead. And this mead will allow the hero or the initiate to be restored to life with new knowledge and new skills, and often a new title to go with it. So it was about initiation rituals and how these are reflected in Norse myths, which means that it was a very powerful argument for the fact that these myths have very deep roots in pagan heathen lore. Because there has been a big discussion in the academic world about whether the Edda poems are, you know, genuine heathen sources or just invented in the medieval time. And I think that the fact that these myths actually follow a structure of initiation that just could not have been invented by Christian people in the medieval time, because they wouldn't have known these things and they would not have felt, you know, allowed to be to write about these things. So I think it's an argument for Edda poetry being actually genuinely pagan in origin.
So Snorre Sturlason, he wasn't just making it up as he was going. That's the point there. And if that was the case too, he would have, if he was writing it primarily from a Christian perspective, I think he would done more to slam it and talk about it in a negative connotation, I would think.
Yeah, but it's very good we had this this discussion in the academic world, because there have been so many good arguments put forth by many others than myself for why the Norse, why these Edda myths are quite genuine, genuinely hidden. Of course, there could have been some changes during the time when they were written down, which
sure.
was later, but for the most part, it's all those who now study these myths seriously on a university level and who write books about it, they are very, very clear about that. So I'm very happy that, I contributed to that in my own way, but I don't know if anyone has noticed that. because my thesis, it was accepted, and I was told that I had proven my point to satisfaction, but, to my confusion, there was no actual interest in letting me continue that research. So
interesting. So who was reviewing this? Was it the University of Oslo?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they sort of, I won't go into the whole thing, but anyway, my thesis was stored away in the university library along with, you know, countless other interesting research works on the subject that is
really?
never never known to anybody but those who have access to the university and who are, you know, driven by that particular interest to actually go in there and get the library card. And, I read so many interesting papers about this and that. Yeah.
Have you done anything to try to kind of unlock them from the grips of the gatekeepers of the information?
Some of it, just a few articles I think I put out on my website actually. And then I've written that this is actually a summary or a translation summary from someone else then, because a lot of it is written in Norwegian, so obviously people won't be able to read it.
Yeah.
I wrote it in English because I had lived a long time in England and. Before I went to the university, and they wanted us to write in English if we could, because they had started to invite foreign students for this kind of courses. So, but anyway, I was sort of felt a bit left out, and I felt that I had discovered something of great importance. Nobody had, as I saw it, presented such a sort of wholesome thesis before, because I covered a lot of poems, and in my opinion, I meant that I thought that I had offered a new approach to understanding Norse myth. But and I had been, you know, looking forward to continuing that work at the university with the support and help from other researchers. And I even talked to some. I mean, there were a lot of professors there who were very positive, but they didn't have the power needed to help me. So eventually, it's some. Times how the academic world works, and I was, you know, simply ignored. And after a while, I just decided to start to write a book and just leave university career dreams. And
how sad, though, you know, someone who has the interest, the drive, you have the background, obviously, you've studied it, and then they just drop the ball like this. Is that indicative, do you think, of the study overall of Norse tradition in the Scandinavian countries?
No, I think it's a lot about who you know. If you know the right people, you get the position. If you don't know the right people, you don't get the position. And I had spent most of my time in abroad.
Right.
So I didn't have any contacts. I thought I had this sort of naive notion that my, just to be able to write a proper thesis that was well researched and put forward in a way that was acceptable, which it was. They told me so themselves, but I thought that could be enough, but it wasn't.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the details of the initiation rituals of the path of seeking the visions, of facing those trials and everything else? What was some of the new stuff that you found?
Well, I looked at I began starting to try to prove that shamanism had this very important place in Norse hedonism. But when I was trying to look for shamanistic elements, I found that the elements are there, but they didn't complete the picture, basically. And I started to look for something else, and then I discovered this figure that kept appearing. That was the woman who served the mead. That's why my thesis is called The Maiden with the Mead, because she was there, and whenever she appeared in a story, there would be the same procedures happening. And it was, I mean, they're very detailed descriptions, and they're very, very varied. There's a lot of variation, so obviously people didn't do exactly the same thing, but they followed a similar step-by-step procedure, which would start with the vision quest. I call it the vision quest, based on Native American vision quest concepts, but it's the same, because people would do things like sitting on a burial mound, for example, or going to a sacred grove and meditate, or sleeping by a river, or going on top of a mountain, or, well, as Odin does, he hangs for 9 days and nights.
Right.
The 9 days and nights would also often be repeated. And when they did this, they would always have a vision of a maiden. That would be the same, the maiden with the mead. And she would appear to them and give them some tips, some advice on how to proceed. So that was the Vision Quest, and then followed by the Vision. This is the same in all the stories in some way or other. Of course, some elements will be more detailed in some stories and only slightly alluded to in other stories. But then after the Vision, they will always go into the underworld, to Hel or to the giant world. That sometimes, you know, they blend together a bit in the Norse myths. They didn't have this sort of geographical borders in their mythological cosmos as we often think they did. There's a lot of blending together here. But anyway, they would go into that world and they would face the darkness and they would face monsters. And one of the things that opened this up for me was the stories about Helgi in the Edda. Helgi is a young prince, a young hero, warrior who is reborn. So he has two lives. And in both lives, he has the same Valkyria. That's the maiden with the mead in his case. She's a Valkyria in that case. And he has to fight, in one of those lives, he has to go into a fjord called the Hata Fjord. That means the fjord of hatred. And he has to fight this giant called Hati, which means hatred. And another giant called Hrodmar, which means anger ocean, anger water. And when I translated these names, I was like, wow, this is not about just fighting trolls. This is about fighting some negative qualities within yourself, hatred, anger, and greed. He had to, in his first life, he had to fight by the Frekastein, that means the rock of greed. And he loses that battle. And then he's reborn, and he has to go through exactly the same trials again. And then he wins the Battle of the Rock of Greed eventually, and he goes to Valhalla. But the fact that I had always read these stories that, oh, here is another Viking hero who is fighting monsters, and then he wins the girl. But when you start to look at the meaning of the names and all the small details there and start to compare those with what we know about initiation rituals in many other cultural traditions, then we see there is a lot of similarity there, and that they probably used these stories for allegories, like parables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think, by the way, and for those who don't know, mead is kind of a honey wine, basically. It's fermented honey with water, and then they add, you know, fruits and spices and grains and hops in some cases, too. And do you know if this was spiced with something else, hallucinogenic compounds or anything that actually made them, that started them on their kind of vision journey, if you will?
Yeah, probably. The mead, first of all, in Old Norse, they called it mjöder.
That's
and
right.
Mjöder is cognate with a Sanskrit word from very well known from the Rig Veda in India. That's a work of poetry that was written down. Well, it was created at least 5,000 years ago, they think. And they had something called madu. And that is exactly the same. And it means honey originally. And mead, mjöder, and madu is the same word, basically. It means honey and refers to the honey mead. And the madu is identical to what the Indians then called soma. And soma was a drink that they said could make you immortal. It would make you see the gods and be in their presence, and you would be inspired, you would become enlightened. It was the key to all enlightenment, basically. And the Norse mead is certainly related to that. And you find the same actually in Persian, Iranian mythology from back to the, you know, Zoroaster religion.
Yeah.
They also had this mead that they thought was, if you drank it, you would be filled by all encompassing wisdom. So this is a very, very old and very widespread tradition.
Might go back to an original root point at some far, far, far away point, basically.
And also we know it from Greek mythology as the nectar, the drink of immortality.
Yeah.
And they have many likenesses, all these myths about these, lots of similarities between the Veda, the Iranian Avesta, the Greek myths, and the Norse myths in this case. And we know that at least the Iranian and the Indian version, they in those texts they speak of an actual plant that gave them these revelations, but nobody actually knows exactly what plant was used. So that's a lot of speculation, what kind of plant is being described. So some people think it was wild rye, which has, if it's prepared in certain ways, it gives a sort of, similar to what they use in Brazil. What is that called again?
The ayahuasca or whatever.
Similar effect to ayahuasca. While other people think that it was the fly agaric, you know, the mushroom.
Yeah, that's right. And the rye would be the ergot compound and the fungus on the rye, I believe.
I think so, yeah. That's right, yeah. So in the Osterberg ship, we have this tapestry where you see 9 men hanging in a grove full of serpents. The trees that they're hanging from are made out of serpents. They're hanging like Odin did during his initiation. And there are 9 men. You remember the 9 knights that he hung?
Yeah.
Above that grove of trees where people, where men are hanging, there are 3 women figures. And beneath them, these women, you know, in between the women and the scene of sacrifice or initiation, there is an image of the fly agaric, a very big one. So, also, in the Osterberg ship, they didn't find any remnants of mushrooms or any other, but they found a whole bag of cannabis seeds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So they had cannabis, at least, they used. And I think that if you put cannabis into a drink, a mead, for example, you probably have a certain effect.
Interesting. I did not know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you won't see in the museum, but it's if you read one of those books about it, you find it.
Yeah. Well, the Osterberg ship is, I mean, it's just an amazing find. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful things I've seen in a long time. We look at the photos, and have you been at the actual museum? Yeah, looked at the...
Oh, yes, lots of times. I was taken there many times when I was a child, and I've been there many times as an adult. It's a great...
Looks like a whale almost or something like that. The underside of it looks like a huge blue whale or something. Almost like they've made it not aerodynamic in this case because it's in water, but you see what I'm saying, of the exact shape of a huge whale, and that's what makes it so efficient as a water vessel, you know?
Yeah, it's a very special ship because of the size of the oars, the size of the oar seats, and things like that in the ship. They thought that people were very small during the Viking Age, but later they have sort of had to admit that people who lived in Scandinavia during the Viking Age were actually very big.
Yeah.
The men were almost as tall as, well, it was completely common for men to be 180, while women were a lot shorter than, they were a lot smaller compared to the men than we are today. But the men were very big. So as someone pointed out to me, one Facebook friend actually said that maybe women actually rowed this ship. And there were 2 women who were buried in it. And it was a ship that was not meant for ocean voyages. It was meant for traveling in, you know, light water in the fjords and the rivers and things like that. So it was a very special ship. So and it's probably ceremonial.
Yeah.
Contained a lot of ceremonial objects in it. So
interesting. Yeah, some finds there are just, I urge people to take a look at an image of it. We'll link a couple of up to so you can see some of the carvings and well, and just the detail that's gone into the carvings, the decorational work is amazing, obviously implying that something else was used. And I believe even that they were, the patterns at some point were colored as well. They found remnants of various types of colors, which have made this stand out, of course, even more. What are some of the symbology in terms of the symbols that we see? I mean, what is with the endless weaving dragons and serpents and, you know, sea monsters and everything else? What is that all about, do you think?
Well, then I will have to just speculate, because I'm not an archaeologist and I can't say things for certain about the Osebergh ship, but from what I understand of that, it's the symbology of the serpents and all the other things on the ship. I recognize these from all the descriptions of the underworld. So, and with that tapestry showing the nine men hanging, and there's also this bed, it's a marital bed in the ship. It makes me think that this was connected to a cult of initiation. I think it's very, very much connected to exactly the sort of initiation cult that that I have been writing about. Oh, yeah, about my books, I didn't really finish. I just ended up with a thesis, didn't I?
You know what we can do then? Let's finish that thought in terms of the books, and then we can take a short break, because we're quickly running out of end time here for the first segment here. So let's talk a little bit more about the books, and then you can, of course, carry on that and mention about your website where people can find your material and pick up copies of the book and everything.
Yes. Because after I sort of started to realize that maybe a university career was not my thing, I started to write a lot, and I kept going for a while. The thesis was published by a German publisher. Well, they called me and asked me if I wanted to publish with them. So I said, yes, of course. This happened in 2009. And so since then, my thesis has been available as a book on Amazon, but I have to say, to my surprise, they set a price on that book, which was extremely high. And so when I complained, they demanded 750 euro in payment for taking the book back to myself. So so far, I have not had the economy to buy that book back. I don't know if this is legal even, but
oh my God, you're kidding? Wow.
No, so in a way, I was happy just because, you know, I got my name there as a published author, but that, you know, people can't really afford to buy the book. So, but on a positive note, almost everything of interest in that thesis is, you know, is presented in some way or other in articles on my website, because they form this thesis form the basis of my later work. So, I have a lot of that on my website and also in my new book, which came out, was published last year, The Seed of Yggdrasil. And that book came into being after I had done a series of lectures on YouTube about the hidden messages in Old Norse myths. I started doing that because I'm sort of brimming over with information. Eventually, I'd studied this for so many years, so seriously, and I just had to share eventually, because I finally, after so many years, I started to feel that I had something to share. And I had such positive feedback from, you know, presenting my work on YouTube as lectures and things, that I learned a lot from that, and well, then the book came, and now I have moved on to writing a novel series. Now, the novel series is called Blade Honor, and it's actually about the Osebergh ship. Eventually it's going to be about the Osebergh ship, because it's about one of the women who were buried in that ship. But it starts out, the first book is called The Hammer of Greatness. It's already out on Amazon and as ebook, and so it's a historical fiction work about the life of the Osebergh priestess, and it begins in the Baltic just before the so-called Viking Age begin. And I want to try to describe Old Norse culture through this series, and I want to try to describe their religion, and I want to describe the various reasons for the Viking Age and what was really behind the Viking attacks.
Well, why don't we, if there's anything more you want to add to that, definitely let's do that. Otherwise, I definitely want to ask you more about that very question, because that's been pondered upon a lot, of course, of what was the incentive for the raids and going out and doing it in such a way that they did. So that's something we could pick up on in the second. Why don't you give us some website addresses and everything else for people where you have it available? And of course, you publish articles regularly. Give us the YouTube address as well, so people can see your videos.
Yes. My website is freya.theladyofthelabyrinth.com. And my YouTube channel is called Lady of the Labyrinth channel. So, and I'm also Lady of the Labyrinth in on Facebook, and I have some Facebook pages as well where it's, you know, with my books, and yeah, I think that was everything.
Very good. Yeah, definitely. I want to just give out that Freya, for those of you who do not know, Freya, freya.theladyofthelabyrinth.com, and we'll have, of course, all the other the YouTube channel, the Facebook page, and everything else up so that you can find Maria's work easily from there. But yeah, let's take a short break here then, Maria. This is very interesting. I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation, so stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more. Please stay with us in the second hour as we go into what set off the Norsemen to go on their Viking raids. We break down the hundreds of years prior activity of the Christians against the Angles, Saxons, and the Jutes at the time when they lived in northern Germany and southern Denmark, the Saxon Wars, among other things. What was it that was so ruthless that set off these people? How was their faith and religion treated? One that had been around for thousands of years before the onset of the new Judaic faith with the tweaks by Rome. We discuss the primary chronicles of the Slavs, where one can find more source material. We talk about the Rus, the Varangians, and what the Christianized kings of Norway began doing against their own people. Pretty ruthless stuff. Later we talk more about creation myth and initiation. You can continue to listen at redicemembers.com. Subscribe and get full access to our archives. We have 8 years of a wide variety of radio programs on all kinds of topics waiting for you. We also have videos, commentary, and much more. We keep inquiring into new areas in history. We try to keep moving, make things interesting, and look into new aspects and new material. We also piece together the puzzle of our past and current times and everything that we've been asked to swallow for the sake of the manipulation and subjugation of our most fundamental basic principles. Please have a look around at redicemembers.com. You don't have to be a member to browse the archives. Now, we have a growing number of fascinating topics. A subscription is about the price of 2 cups of coffee per month, and you can try it out with a 3-month subscription. We'll return on Friday with Daryl Hamamoto from the University of California, Davis, to talk about his book, The Servitors of the Empire, a very interesting perspective on New World Order theory and how the politically correct BS being pushed as the campuses around America play into the much larger agenda of a conspiracy of subjugation. Do not miss it. We'll be right back with Marida Kvillhaug for the continuation of our Norse and Viking series.